Okay, so I want to start out just by letting you know I'm not even going to go near the part of this passage that talks about loving your enemies. So if that's what you're waiting for, set it aside. I read a wonderful commentary on this passage from a Lutheran pastor named the Reverend David Lowes. He's in Minneapolis. And he pointed out two really dangerous temptations when you're wrestling with this passage. And the first one is simply not to take it seriously. He wrote, "I call this the Lutheran temptation, simply because when Lutherans get to really difficult sayings from Jesus, we tend to assume that Jesus didn't really expect us to do these things, only to remind us of our inability to satisfy God's demands so that we might flee to Jesus for forgiveness and grace." I laughed out loud when I read that one. Don't worry about trying to live any of this stuff out that he tells us to do. We're not really expected to. It's only in there to make us realize how impossible it is, how inadequate we are, so that we're forced to rely on God. So that's one temptation. Then he flips it over and says another temptation is exactly the opposite, to take these teachings too seriously, to believe that we actually have it in us to do all of these exceedingly difficult things, and to do it all on our own without needing God's help at all. That one hit a little too close to home for me, as you will hear in a few minutes. But then he suggested jumping to the end of the passage first, to what he calls the ridiculously hard part about being perfect. And I'll come back to what he says about that a little later, because that's the part of the passage that's on my mind and heart this morning. You must be perfect. There is a story in the Jewish mystical tradition that says when God created the world, God formed vessels of clay to hold the divine light. But as God poured the divine light into those vessels, the vessels shattered. The shards were scattered throughout the material world. And so our very world is made up of these fragments, each containing a little bit of the divine light. And our great task as human beings is to piece them all back together, to restore the broken world to wholeness or holiness. It's up to us to put the pieces of the world back together. Now, some people then go a little bit further with that story and say that we each carry within us one of those fragments of holiness, of perfection, that we each contain within ourselves one of those shards of those holy vessels and a glimmer of that divine light. Now, this idea that human beings have within them a little bit of holiness shows up in many of the religious traditions of the world. The Hindus have the greeting namaste, which means that which is divine within me greets that which is divine within you. The first principle of my Unitarian Universalist faith affirms a more humanist understanding of this by lifting up and affirming the inherent worth and dignity of every person. The Quaker faith talks about the light of Christ within each person. The Buddhists remind us that when we meditate, we can breathe into ourselves the essential goodness of the universe. In each case, there's this idea that we embody within us a little bit of perfection, of holiness, of grace. And I find all of those images really beautiful, but that's not what I'm preaching about this morning. Because as much as I love the idea of having within me some fragment of perfection, the fact is, more often, I just feel like a whole jumbled up collection of fragments, broken bits and pieces that are not at all perfect and that don't come together with any sense of wholeness or cohesion. And maybe some of you know that feeling too. Pat invited you to reflect on it in his opening remarks. When have you felt fragmented, broken? Sometimes life is just a little too much, and we don't feel as though we'll ever be able to get it all back together. And I don't know about you, but when I'm having one of those days, I don't sense within me even a fragment of perfection. And I have deeply ingrained in me this idea that somehow I ought to be able to take all those broken pieces of my life and put them back together, to mend my fragmented life and make it all make sense, that that's my responsibility, and when I can't do it, I feel like a failure. Now, for a long time, I blamed that dynamic of feeling like a failure when I couldn't fix my life on the fact that I grew up as a Unitarian Universalist during the heyday of the humanist movement. And I absorbed all those wonderful messages about human potential, and they backfired. And I want to explain what I mean by that. Now, this is not a sermon on Unitarian history, but if I don't give you a little bit of context, then you won't understand the perspective from which I wrestle with this passage. So bear with me while I go kind of down in the weeds for a few minutes, and then I promise I'll bring it back. One of the primary beliefs that separated the early Unitarians, and I'm talking about the early 1800s in this country, from the more traditional Christians of their day, was the radical idea that human nature was essentially good. The prevailing theology of the day said that humanity was utterly depraved. This is one of the 5 points of Calvinism, total depravity. As one professor of mine put it, we were just good enough to understand how very bad we were. But the Unitarians held up a really different view of human nature. They believed that humanity was good, or at least filled with the potential for good. So one Unitarian minister back in 1886 took the 5 points of Calvinism and completely revisioned them for a Unitarian theology and called them the 5 points of the new theology. A little arrogant there maybe, but it was new and it was his theology. And these 5 points were still widely quoted almost 100 years later when I was growing up in the Unitarian Church. And they were the fatherhood of God, the brotherhood of man, the leadership of Jesus. Unitarians weren't Trinitarians, so they didn't worship Jesus, but they did follow Jesus. And getting into the Trinitarian Unitarian stuff would be a different sermon altogether, so don't worry, we're not going there this morning. But it's the final 2 points that I really want you to hear: salvation by character and the progress of mankind onward and upward forever. Now, we have to adapt these a little bit because of gender-inclusive language, which nobody thought about in the late 1800s. So think about it this way: the nurturing nature of God, or the parenthood of God, the kinship of all humanity, the leadership of Jesus, salvation by character, and our human progress onward and upward forever. Now, that is heady stuff, but it's also really heavy stuff, too. If you take that phrase, salvation by character, that is an awful lot of responsibility resting squarely on human shoulders. While the more orthodox Christians were fighting over whether we're saved solely by God's grace or by earning God's favor and grace through our good works, the Unitarians took this much more humanistic stand and said, God gave us character and potential. We are saved by the exercise of that character. Now, this emphasis on self-development and human potential was deeply empowering as a counterpoint to the prevailing theology of the day that had no room at all for human goodness or agency. But as empowering as it might be to think about being able to save ourselves by virtue of our own character, it leaves me feeling completely inadequate. Because the sorry fact is that my character does not feel strong enough for the task of my salvation. And I'm willing to bet many of you would share that feeling. And then to make it worse, the Unitarians also loved to lift up that phrase from the Enlightenment about the perfectibility of humankind. Now, it's one thing to talk about human progress, and yes, we can keep growing and changing and getting better, and religion should challenge us to grow and get better, right? That's a big piece of what religion is about. But perfectibility? That takes me back to the pastor I quoted earlier, saying that one of the dangers in reading passages like the Sermon on the Mount is to think that we can actually do all these extraordinarily difficult things on our own. And that's what I grew up believing I was supposed to be able to do, to perfect myself. And that's a heavy burden. So the Unitarianism of my youth taught me self-reliance and responsibility and self-respect and human dignity, and I think those are all wonderful things. But it did not leave much room for weakness or brokenness or alienation or feeling inadequate or incomplete. Those were character flaws. So part of the powerful pull toward Christianity for me, toward the metaphors and stories of the Christian tradition, was the way that that story makes room in our lives, in our hearts, for grief and brokenness and incompleteness and grace. What a relief to set down the burden of having to perfect myself. So imagine my surprise when I began hearing from Christian friends, including some of you, that many of you grew up with the exact same messages about having to be perfect that I did. They just came from a different source. You got it from the Gospel of Matthew. You must be perfect. I thought it was just the Unitarians who laid that burden on their children, but no, you guys did the exact same thing. And I have heard stories, and you have heard them too, of faithful, loving, God-fearing, right-living people who approached their death with great fear in case they hadn't quite been good enough. And that breaks my heart. Now, when I was doing some reading in my preparation for this morning, I was reminded that despite this seemingly heavy demand from Jesus, he did not, in fact, expect his followers to be perfect. In fact, almost everything he did and said pointed in a very different direction from perfection. The laws in the book of Leviticus required perfection, at least from the priests. Your sacrifices had to be perfect and without blemish. Anyone who was going to approach the altar had to be perfect and without blemish, because otherwise they would profane the sanctuary of God. The laws around ritual purity were very strict. But Jesus let everyone approach him. He took them as they came. He might have then expected them to make some changes, do some improving, but he didn't say, go and become perfect and then I'll heal you. Probably the most profound example of this for me was the story of the woman with the flow of blood. You all grew up with that story. I encountered it first as a young adult, and it blew me away. This woman who would have been a total outcast. She was ritually impure because of her bleeding. She would have been shunned by her community, living on the margins. She had the temerity to reach out and touch Jesus' robe. And he felt the power of her touch and turned to talk with her. And the text says she told him the whole story, which would have included all those shameful blemishes of her character. And instead of rejecting her, he called her daughter. He said, daughter, your faith has healed you. How many of us feel as if we can tell the whole story of who we are, blemishes and all, and still be accepted that fully, whether by another human being or by God? Some of you have heard me tell the story of my spiritual director when I went with a struggle about some really bad mistakes I had made and was feeling very deeply unhappy with myself. And she was trying to convince me that God still delighted in me just as I was. And I had to ask her to hold on to that belief for me because I couldn't go there. And I'm guessing most of us have trouble believing that on our bad days. We may give it lip service, but most of us still live in fear for being judged for all the ways that we're not good enough. And I don't think it makes a lot of difference whether you approach it from the humanist side or the Christian side. It's still a heavy load to carry. I remember about 25 years ago in my first ministry, I got a note in the mail sent to my apartment, not to the church office, from an older man in the church, highly respected, really one of the elders of the congregation who I admired greatly. That's before the days when anyone could just send you an email, so he actually put a note in the mail to me, and I stood there in my apartment looking at the return address on the envelope, and my first thought was, oh no, what did I do to offend Jack? When I finally had the courage to open the envelope, it was a thank you note for the sermon I had preached the week before, which he had particularly appreciated. Now, I won't ask for a show of hands, but I'm willing to bet that at least some of you have had a similar experience of assuming the worst when, in fact, what was coming toward you was something positive. Now, if that's what we put ourselves through when we haven't actually done anything wrong, what do we do to ourselves when we have messed up, disappointed, or failed someone? Because we all do. Inevitably, we're juggling a lot of balls in a very complex world, and we're going to drop some sometimes. And sometimes we drop the really important ones, and bad things happen. I recently disappointed some people pretty badly who are very dear to me. We've all been there. And it's easy to get lost in self-condemnation because, after all, we're supposed to be perfect. So let's go back to that word perfect. Because it turns out that the Greek word in this passage, telos, doesn't really mean what we think of when we think of perfect. It doesn't mean without error, without flaws or blemishes. It implies the idea of being what we are meant to be. To quote David Lowes again, that pastor, the Lutheran I was talking about at the beginning, I said I'd come back to him. He said, the word we translate as perfect is actually the Greek word telos and implies less a moral perfection than it does the idea of reaching one's intended outcome. The telos of an arrow shot by an archer is to reach its target. The telos of a peach tree is to bear peaches, which means that we might just translate this passage more loosely to mean, be the person and community God created you to be, just as God is the one God is supposed to be. So that's why I love the somewhat loose translation from Eugene Peterson of this passage from Matthew in his book, The Message, which ends with, in a word, what I'm trying to say is, grow up. Your kingdom subjects, now live like it. Live out your God-created identity. Live generously toward others the way God lives toward you. This is something we can grow into, a process of rising to the challenge of being who we are meant to be, not perfect, but beautiful and generous and good. And I love this because it brings together that old humanist message of human goodness and potential, which I continue to treasure, but weds it with the embrace of a loving God whose grace helps us to live into that goodness more fully. It's more about becoming whole than it is about becoming perfect. But even if we accept that we are called to wholeness rather than perfection, what do we do with the fact that we still often simply don't feel whole? And I go back to that image of fragmentation that I raised at the beginning of the sermon. I mean, maybe you feel whole most of the time, but I still struggle with feeling broken a lot of the time, feeling like there are all these shattered bits and pieces that I don't know how to make sense out of in my life. And as many of you know, I also struggle with a lot of questions about how to even think about God. So I want to offer one final image. Because a number of years ago, in a worship service at a minister's meeting, a colleague of mine led us in meditation. And at one point, she invited us simply to sit with some part of ourselves that needed care. I was going through a particularly fragmented period at the time, so that's what I sat with. And I tried to visualize all those pieces of myself coming back together, sort of like running the tape in reverse, you know, after something breaks. I wanted to mend the brokenness, to fix what was wrong with me. And I kept trying to form an image in my mind of all those pieces, like jigsaw puzzle pieces, settling into a pattern. And you know the way people sometimes glue the puzzles together to keep them forever? I wanted to glue all the pieces down and make them hold still, and I could not do it. And gradually, as we sat in the silence, I decided to try accepting the fact that all those broken pieces were simply the reality of my life, and that they would always be shifting and changing and moving. and that there was no way to glue them down, that our lives simply are made up of lots of broken moving pieces. Okay, so I tried to accept that, but I thought, well, how am I going to learn to appreciate that image? How can I feel good about that image? And as I wondered that, a picture of a kaleidoscope rose in my mind, and I began to feel different. Because a kaleidoscope is made of pieces of broken glass, just broken fragments of colored glass, which are all put in together, and when you turn it, they keep forming different patterns. And each pattern is perfectly, intricately beautiful. And it can only be created because of the broken pieces. The beauty is born of the brokenness. And so I began to think of God as the wholeness that holds all the broken pieces and just keeps turning the kaleidoscope and creating different beautiful patterns out of our imperfection. Now, accepting our brokenness doesn't let us off the hook for all our mistakes. We still need to grow up, as Eugene Peterson said. We need to learn from those mistakes and grow and deepen and keep getting better. I had to go to those people I had disappointed and apologize and seek their forgiveness. But at the same time, even in those places of feeling broken and inadequate, we can still trust that the overall patterns of our lives still create beauty. We may not be perfectible, but we can be beautiful in our imperfection, held in the wholeness of God. So the kaleidoscope has become my new metaphor for God, forming endless patterns of wholeness and beauty out of the broken shards of our lives. So when my character feels woefully inadequate for the task of salvation, as it often does, I can rest in that larger wholeness that somehow continues to make beautiful and perfect patterns out of my broken and imperfect self. So I invite us to take a moment to turn to one another in a sort of passing of the peace, to look at one another and see within each other that beauty and holiness that we each contain, even if in fragments, and just take a moment to offer each other a blessing to see the beauty in each person we encounter. And you might want to offer a word or a phrase with that, or just a handshake or a hug.